For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and an empty chair representing Mark Tuttle.
Mark's not here.
Mark is on husband duty.
He sure is.
He got in here this morning and...
got into the cave, got comfy, got his coffee.
And then got the call from his wife
right.
that the car is not working. So we're going to go ahead and run the show. And Mark, we hope everything works out for the best. You get that thing up and running. But... last week, we talked about dystopia and post-apocalyptic literature. And those
easy for you
things.
To say.
Not really. Not really. Not
yes,
this time
I remember.
Of day. But now we've had a couple weeks or so to digest this recent election.
Oh, yes.
And there are those who would describe this as a post-apocalyptic election.
Yeah.
So is the end of the world coming because of this election?
Well, I think one of the features, there's so much we could talk about in the wake of the midterm elections, but one of the features I think that's top of my mind and maybe what we'll use the program to sort of unpack a little bit is there certainly was this impulse towards socialism with specifically with candidates who specifically declared their allegiance to being socialist and a socialist agenda running under the banner of the Democratic Socialist Party. So that's really caught my attention.
Well, then the best thing we can do is turn this one over to an expert. So
absolutely.
We're going to bring
in. So that excludes me.
We're going to bring in a Cold War expert.
Yes.
Historian, author, and all-around good guy, friend of the cave. Dr. Paul Kengor will join us right after this break. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more here on Catholic Radio Indy.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a ministry reaching out to Central Indiana and beyond. We have information available about what's happening in parishes here in the Hoosier Heartland, as well as access to the latest from Rome, plus apologetics and authentic Catholic teaching. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. At this time, I'm delighted to welcome back into the Catholic Cave Dr. Paul Kengor. He's an author and professor of political science at Grove City College. He's the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. That's a think tank policy center. We're delighted... outstanding guest of the show. Welcome back, Dr. Kengor.
Yeah, Tim, Mark, good to be with you guys. Thanks.
Well, it's terrific to have you back in the cave, especially we're only about a week out from the midterm elections, and I can't think of a better person to ask this question of, which is, so what happened and where do we go from here?
Yeah, and by the way, let me say Indianapolis is truly one of my favorite cities in the country. And I mean that sincerely. It really is. It's a great city.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, in your state, I'd say one of the most important elections was the Donnelly race. Right?
Oh, yes.
And, you know, that's the case. There were I guess we'll kind of start at the beginning. So the big news here, of course, was that basically the House and the Senate. And the U.S. House, it looks like the Democrats won that with a lead at this point. I'm looking at Real Clear Politics this morning, which has a pretty reliable tracking poll. Probably about 25 to 30 seat advantage for the Democrats over Republicans. So you're now going to have a Democrat Party run House. And, I mean, that's a big victory for them. But in a sense, guys, really, every midterm for every new president is always a flip of usually around 30 seats. So
why is that?
Why do they
tend to flip in the midterms?
Well, it's a good question, and it might reflect Americans' sort of natural proclivity or preference for divided government, which it's kind of funny. Everybody always says, why don't they get anything done in Washington? Well, if you elect a Republican president and then a Democratic Congress, you're kind of, you know, you're voting for nothing to get done in Washington. And my father-in-law told me that he used to split his ticket all the time between, you know, vote for one party for the House, another for the presidency. That way the one guy could keep the other guy in check. And I think that's sort of an old tradition in American politics. But it's sort of ironic because the Democrats aren't really one to check somebody because they're, you know, they're the party of activist government, progressivism, what Woodrow Wilson called the administrative state. You know, they want to use government to actually do things, right? And so in that sense, it's kind of, but today, what's happened in this most recent election, this was sort of the Trump resistance, right? The anti-Trump forces.
Right.
And Democrats around the country, liberals, were mobilized to run to the polls and try to stop Donald Trump. And that's basically what happened. But also in that sense, I would add here, given this sort of intensity and, you know, the anger even of the Trump resistance, as it called itself, and the fact that the opposition party is expected to pick up around 30 seats typically in the midterm, you might even argue that the Democrats slightly underperformed in winning the House.
Well, that was the blue wave, right, was what we were hearing about a few weeks before that seemed to have cooled off a little bit. But is that what you're talking about, that the blue wave turned more into not so much a wave but more of maybe a puddle?
Yeah, and in fact, to give you a sense of comparison, in the 2010 election, Republicans gained 63 seats.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that was a huge now, to be fair, I think that was the biggest flip in the House since about maybe 1948. Mm. So 2010 was really historic. That was the backlash against Barack Obama as president and the Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid Congress. So this gain by the Democrats wasn't even half of what Republicans had in 2010. But still, I mean, you know, kudos to them. I mean, they wanted to take back the House. They did it. What was it, a blue wave? I think a more insightful phrase for this comes from Van Jones.
Oh, the liberal
right. The liberal progressive pundit for CNN, and he said this wasn't a blue wave. This is a blue war, as he called it, blue war. And he called it a blue war, a quote, infestation of hate and division. That's how he put it.
Yikes.
And it's really true.
What do you think accounts for? I mean, everyone talks about politics being very polarized, which I think any observer probably can reach that conclusion. But why do you think it's the temperature, though, of the polarization is so high?
Yeah, well, the Democrats and liberals would say, you know, they'd blame it on Donald Trump, and they say it's Trump with his Twitter account, it's his rhetoric, it's his incendiary rhetoric, and look, I mean, I'll just say I'm a Republican, but I concede that Donald Trump is one of the most vitriolic, incendiary.
He throws punches.
I mean, that's what Trump is. There's no question about it. So whereas in the past, I mean, you could get, and liberals and Democrats who are listening, look, I remember when you guys called Reagan a racist, okay? When you called George W. Bush, you couldn't have found a guy more civil, whose motto was turn the other cheek, you were calling him a fascist and a hater. And you know, so they're always calling people that they disagree with on the conservative side Nazis, fascists, racists, all kinds of terrible things. And now when they say it with Donald Trump, there's a lot of people on the Trump side that are saying, well, you guys say that all the time, right? And now you want to say that Trump is a Nazi or a fascist? You know, we're not listening to you. But the fact of the matter is, you know, aside from those kind of really overheated descriptions, I mean, I got a text on on the Tuesday morning of the vote from a Catholic Democrat friend of mine who sent me the famous admonition in Nazi Germany, right? First they came for the socialists, and I said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I said nothing. Then they came for the Jews, and I said nothing. Then they came for me. And I'm like, come on, Todd, take it easy. Donald Trump is not leading a secret Gestapo group. Cool down a little bit, okay?
Right.
I mean, you want to blame him for incendiary rhetoric? I mean, come on, a Nazi? I know you don't like the guy, but a Nazi? And this is a friend of mine who's a historian of all things, but that's how sort of jacked up they were, and I guess maybe my point here, Tim, is that they might be accusing Trump of being incendiary and vitriol and angry rhetoric, but they're pretty good at it themselves, and they've got allies like Antifa going around the country protesting, dressing like ISIS guys. Black hoods, starting mob scenes. They are, ask anybody, watch Fox News on any given night. They're outside the house of Tucker Carlson the last few nights while Tucker's doing his show. They're literally pounding on his back door while his wife is in the kitchen. Screaming,
let me into
your house!
Right.
They confront Ted Cruz in a restaurant. They beat up Rand Paul in his front yard, right? They go to a Republican softball game, a guy with a gun, and they start shooting up the field and almost killed Steve Scalise. So the left is pretty good at vitriol and anger as well. So we're looking at a time right now in American politics where civility and discourse is at an all-time low, and tied to this, your question about the current midterm elections. Well, folks, I'm sorry to report this, but it's only going to get far, far worse because the next 2 years of this new Democratic Congress is going to be an ongoing, incessant, constant, day-by-day, moment-to-moment attempt to get the scalp of Donald Trump. And Maxine Waters of the Finance Committee, they're going to be demanding his tax returns. They're going to be looking into Russia. They're going to turn over every rock that they can to try to find some way to impeach the guy or obstruct him or run him out of office. So if you thought civility in American politics was at an all-time low, you ain't seen nothing yet.
You think it's going to get a lot worse? Well, we're speaking with Dr. Paul Kangor here in the Catholic Cave. He's an author, professor of political science at Grove City College. I know you're, among other things, you are a Reagan expert. And so one question, actually, Kent and I were talking about this a few days ago. So Reagan had his opponents, but he was able to find some common ground with Tip O'Neill, who was a Democrat and Speaker of the House, and they were able to get some things done. What's changed between then and because Reagan, the Republicans and Democrats have often had different, have different platforms. They're trying to accomplish, they conceive of government differently. But what's really changed between the Reagan, Tip O'Neill era and what we're likely to face with the Trump and, let's say, Pelosi become Speaker of the House again?
Well, even in Reagan's day, Tim, I mean, the other side was very nasty, and no one remembers this. It's completely forgotten, but Tip O'Neill, and I think it was at the 1984 Democratic Convention, referred to Ronald Reagan as evil, mean, and cruel.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, with ice water in his veins.
But that's
okay. No one remembers that because they... they tend to look back, and Democrats often do this. They say, ooh, we long for the days when Ronald Reagan. I'm like, do you guys remember what you said about Reagan? I mean, I lived through that era. I remember them blaming Reagan for homelessness, for AIDS. They blamed Reagan for the AIDS epidemic.
Oh, I kind of remember that.
They really did. They staged die-ins outside of the White House. Ronald Reagan was the nuclear warmonger who was going to blow up the world. And of course, George W. Bush, I mentioned him again because Bush couldn't have been a nicer guy. they were vicious to George W. Bush. And I would say the difference between Bush and Trump is that Trump at least fights back.
Yeah, right? He's a counterpuncher, to be sure.
He is. He's a counterpuncher. But he does fan the flames, probably more than any other recent president that we've had, you know, Democrat or Republican. But so I don't know. I don't know if there was ever really a peaceful time in American politics, even the American founding. I mean, don't forget one of our most important founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, was shot and killed in a duel by the sitting vice president of the United States, Aaron Burr, right?
Well, I remember the election of 1828, where you have Adams versus Jackson, and Jackson's wife dies, and he blames it on the rhetoric that was leveled against them because they were married, but she hadn't really secured a divorce yet. And so there that point, there was a lot of – so maybe looking back over time, we tend to get rose-colored glasses a little bit and think that bygone years were the eras of civility, where maybe that's just not the case. But you think it's even going to get you think it's even going to rev up even a little bit more, especially now that we have a divided government.
And I would add this. I think what's unquestionably worse than ever – would be the civility among the general public. And you guys have probably seen this, you know, just look at your email accounts, right? I mean, the language that people use to me when they disagree with me or hear me on the radio and don't like something that I said. I mean, I had one guy, I frequently do a syndicated, nationally syndicated Catholic radio show, and this guy was so vicious. So nasty, and I remember the last email that he sent me. The subject had said, "Hey, fascist," and then he put in a series of three or four invectives I can't even abbreviate.
Oh, no.
on the air, and I usually ignored this guy, and this time I responded and I said, "How dare you talk to anybody like this?" And right. and he's Catholic too. And I said, yourself a Catholic, yeah. I said, "Don't you dare email me again, or I will alert authorities or something like that." And I would have loved to have said to him, "Hey, why don't I come to Chicago and you and I can settle this like a couple of real men?" But the first thing he would have done would have been called his lawyer, right? And then I would have been fired from my job at Grove. Just to show what a man of character he is, right? But that's the kind of nastiness that we see in our everyday discourse. And I remember the men of my grandfather's generation, 30, 35 years ago. They were gentlemen. People didn't talk like that. They didn't act like that. And women as well. The language that you hear from women also. So to tie all of this back to our Catholic faith, I think this has to do with the decline in a Christian culture, in the status of Christendom in the United States. I mean, once upon a time, people were churched. They went to Mass every week, and people learned that as a Christian, as a Catholic, you just simply didn't talk to other people that way. But in a time when the largest growing religious group are the so-called nuns, N-O-N-E, the people who claim no religious affiliation, and where the number of people believe in God has been dropping like a percentage point a year, I think it's now down to 70%, which is the lowest it's been in America since Pew Research started asking that question. Mm-hmm. I think it's only going to get worse.
Well, it's the rhetoric. I think what I find very dismaying, disheartening is it's one thing to actively and passionately engage another person's arguments or their policies or their perspective. It's a different thing to attack the person, and I think that's where some of the change that I've noticed has come in is that it's far more about ad hominem attacks versus citing, you know, specific policies or statements or things like that to disagree with. And I think once you engage in personal attacks, attacking the person rather than their positions, then emotions, then things can get really explosive.
Yeah, and that's what's happening. And look at the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, right?
Right.
I mean, that was just absolutely horrific. And Christine Blasey Ford, I mean, they aired all of that out on national television. It was like, I mean, in the old days, I'll give you a historical example. 1948, when Whitaker Chambers accused Alger Hiss of being a Soviet spy, all of that stuff was initially heard behind closed doors at the Senate committee, actually the House committee. And it wasn't until the House committee had a chance to fully interview both of these men that they eventually did the public testimony where the media was invited to that. But with Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, that was all just spilled right out before the cameras on national television, and it ended up where she named four alleged witnesses, people who were there, and then when the FBI investigated it, they found out that none of the four could corroborate her story. Now that being the case, that should have been the very first thing that the Senate Judiciary Committee noted, and then it should have never made it to the TV cameras, right?
Right.
Because I don't know what happened with her. If something happened to her, that's terrible. But she named four witnesses. None of them could corroborate it. And yet that was all spilled out on national television. And once that happened, other women came forward, including, who was the one, Julie Swetnick? Was that her name?
Right.
She accused Brett Kavanaugh of leading a gang rape club at Georgetown Prep.
Right. Outrageous.
And then I think it was MSNBC interviewed her, and she's like, well, I don't know. I mean, I did see him next to, I think, the cooler or the beer keg at one of the parties. And MSNBC is even saying, well, we couldn't confirm any of her story. Well, then why are you airing this on national television?
Yeah, especially an accusation like that.
And that's the one where Brett Kavanaugh exploded, right? So this is a joke. That one's a joke. You can't destroy somebody. I mean, he's got a mother, a wife, daughters. Like you said, he'll never coach girls basketball ever again after this. You got to be more careful with how you treat people's character.
Well, especially with accusations that are that inflammatory, you'd think that you would want to bring in careful evidence. But I think you're right. I mean, one of the critical mistakes was airing it out kind of raw, if you will, in the public square without doing some due diligence around checking facts and evidence before it got on television. But it seems, again, that Kavanaugh may go down as one of those instances of the era of, you know, personal destruction as part of our politics.
Right, right. No, I think so. I think that's absolutely right.
Well, we're speaking with Dr. Paul Kangor of Grove City College. You're a professor of political science, a historian, among other things that I admire about your work that you've done in your scholarship. You're author of tons of books. One of my favorite, and we've had you on the show to talk about it before, and we had an event in town here in Indianapolis, was on A Pope and a President. Let me ask you this, Dr. Kangor. I want to pivot the conversation just a little bit towards socialism. We've had now, it seems like we're having increasingly, we're having on the, at least on the Democrat side, at least one candidate and maybe others that are unabashedly signaling that they're socialists. We've had the Bernie Sanders, but then we've got others that are beginning to sort of follow suit. Could you maybe define for us a little bit what socialism is, or what, at least in the contemporary setting, what socialism is, what they're advocating for, and why that may or may not be problematic for Catholics?
Well, and Pope Pius XI said one cannot be at the same time a true Catholic and a true socialist, right? So you're right off the bat, our church condemns that. And he used the word socialism there, not communism. I run into this all the time from socialists saying, you know, I'm a socialist, not a communist, or I'm a democratic socialist, right? They make these distinctions, but socialism, communism, both of them are rooted in communist ideology. Karl Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto describe socialism as a transitionary step on the road to communism. Oh, so Lord. You go from basically, So the long sweep of history is from feudalism to capitalism to socialism to communism. So socialism is a step along that road. And remember, folks, right, the USSR, the Soviet Union, that second S stood for socialist, right? Soviet Socialist Republic. And the Soviets would refer to themselves as socialists. You could go to the website of People's World or Communist Party USA, and they'll never use the word communist. They'll use the word socialist throughout. In fact, actually, to be completely blunt, if you go there, they typically describe themselves as progressive more often than they do socialist. So they use all those words interchangeably. And lest anyone think that this isn't relevant to what we're talking about today, well, this year, in the 2018 election, more Democratic Socialist of America members and the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, go to their website. They claim to be the largest socialist organization in the United States. They have probably about 50,000 members. And to give you an idea, Communist Party USA only has about 5,000 members. But they are now running candidates throughout the country on the Democratic Party ticket. They're not running on the Democratic Socialists of America ticket. They're running on the Democratic Party ticket. Right here in my backyard, Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania, we have two of them. One of them is named Summer Lee, and the other is Sarah Inamorato. They're both DSA members. They ran against two traditional Catholic Democrats in Western PA, the Costas boys, their cousins from Western PA. Everyone knows them around here. And they were beat in the primary by Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato.
These socialists.
Yet they face no Republican challenger in the fall. And why would they, given the district that they run in?
Okay.
And they're both now on their way to the Pennsylvania State House as elected socialists. And from a national level, the most famous in the country right now is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was just elected 28 years old, right? The youngest woman ever elected to the Congress. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. She's a staunch socialist. And Tom Perez, who's the current chairman of the DMC, of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, he says Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, quote, represents the future of our party, unquote. Represents the future of our party.
Yikes.
So a socialist DSA member, right, represents the future of the Democratic Party. I mean, if you tell that to John F. Kennedy or Robert F. Kennedy or Harry Truman, they would roll over in their graves,
right?
If they heard that. But that's where they are. And I would add here too, guys, not only did the Democrats this year run more socialist, literal socialist, than they ever had before, but they ran a huge, so many that I can't even, I don't think I can even try to quantify it, a huge number of so-called self-identified LGBTQ candidates all over the country. So there's been a radical transformation, to borrow from Obama's language, fundamental transformation of the Democratic Party over the last, say, like, well, since Obama. But in particular, we really saw it in this last midterm election. It's going to have a huge effect for Catholics on matters of religious liberty, abortion funding, the so-called LGBTQ issues. It's going to, you're really going to see this affected in what becomes legislation and the battles that play out in the next couple years and then in the decades to come.
When it comes to the DSA, these Democrat Socialists, what would you say are a few the changes that they're hoping to make going into elected office? How is moving in a socialist direction different from what we currently enjoy as Americans?
Well, they claim that they favor the common ownership of the means of production, which is the classic definition of socialism. If you were to Google right now definition of socialism, you know, the first things that would pop up on your screen would probably be like a Merriam-Webster short definition, a short little Wikipedia definition. And I guarantee you, if there's only two sentences, one of them is going to say common ownership of the means of production. So that, you know, that's one thing that they seek. And what that means is that the government takes control of, through management and ownership, various industries, factories, right? I mean, depending
the
on
commercial,
which,
kind of the commercial society.
Right. And give you an example that even most softer socialists couldn't argue with. I don't even need to point to the socialists of Hitler's Germany and them taking over car companies and that kind of thing, or the Bolsheviks with them taking over everything. Just take, for example, the Fabian socialists and the Clement Attlee government of Britain after World War II. They nationalized airlines, transportation, rail, coal, gas, healthcare, NHS, the National Health Service in Britain. I mean, by the time they were done, within a couple years, they had nationalized close to a quarter of the economy. So a good question that you could ask to whatever socialist friend you might have in America would be, hey, tell me, in your perfect world, what would you nationalize? What would you turn over to the government? And I guarantee you they'll say health care, for one thing.
Oh, that's the starting point, yeah.
Yeah, it is. That's the starting point. And if somebody thinks, well, it's just health care. Health care is like a fifth of our economy.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. It's at least a sixth. I used to work in the healthcare industry. I know those numbers up and down. So that would be one. And then if you say to them, well, okay, how about airlines, right? You know, how about coal? How about natural gas?
And right.
Some of those they would be happy
yeah.
to take.
You right? might see cap and trade come back. Who knows?
Right. Yeah, so it would be, for them, it probably be a matter of picking and choosing what they wanted to take over. But I think the more striking thing about the modern day socialists, and again, go to People's World, which is the flagship publication of Communist Party USA, go to the Trotskyist Workers' World Party, go to some of these different websites, and you'll see that a lot of times they're not talking about industries and taking over industries. They're talking cultural stuff. They're talking same-sex marriage, transgenderism, suing bakers and florists. A lot of it are things that Marx and Engels wouldn't even recognize, kind of cultural Marxism.
Right. And, why is that? Why do you see – well, let me just remind our audience that we're speaking with Dr. Paul Kengor. He's a prolific author, Cold War historian, professor of political science at Grove City College, great friend of the show, Catholic Radio Indy, and we've been talking post-election, and now we've been talking some of the fallout from that, but socialism, and why is it? It does seem like you have put your finger on something that I've noticed as well. I mean, these are sort of odd bedfellows for socialists to embrace, say, LGBTQ type ideology and agendas. What does that roll up into sort of a postmodernism, or why do you see this wedding of Marxism with some other identity politics, if you will?
Yeah, it's a good question, and a lot of people that are really informed in this area would say, well, you have to go to the Frankfurt School and the cultural Marxists of the 1920s, 30s, into the 1960s, Herbert Marcuse, Wilhelm Reich, who actually wrote the book, The Sexual Revolution. He was one of the original cultural Marxists of the Frankfurt School. And some people will want to separate that from Marx, and that's fair because these guys were much more radical culturally. But even then, if you look at what Marx and Engels actually wrote in the Communist Manifesto, they said communism seeks to abolish all traditional relations. Marx, in a letter to Alexander Ruge, said that communism represents, quote, the ruthless criticism of everything that exists, unquote. They talked about the overthrow of all existing social conditions. That's a direct quote right out of the Communist Manifesto.
Wow.
By the way, a shameless plug here, my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, I have all those quotations laid out. So if anybody wants to know where they could get those and see all of them and see all of them footnoted, that's all there. And they also talked about, in the Communist Manifesto, abolition of the family. They used those exact words. And the exact phrase, it says, abolition of the family, exclamation mark, even the most radical flare up at this infamous proposal of the communists. Now, that's Marx and Engels writing in 1848. So 1848, they can already say that abolition of the family is an infamous proposal of the communists. So right there for people thinking, well, Marx and Engels were probably about, what, like factory working conditions, right? Well, they were, but they also talked about things like abolition of the family. They talked about abolition of religion. They hated religion.
Right.
And go prior to that, 1826, New Harmony, Indiana, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah, with that, I'm trying to think of the guy who wrote the Declaration of Mental Independence that he delivered July 4th, 1826 in Indiana. That's all in my book, too. But he declared war on what he called the Hydra, the unholy trinity of private property, religion, and family. Family
and marriage.
Oh, good Lord.
Hydra's the arch enemies in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
right. So they've been after... They've been seeking this fundamental transformation of everything. By the way, I should add, with the Catholic Church, the mortal enemy for them of all of this, because
sure,
that's the one institution that all along has defended tradition and the family and property and obviously religion. So the Church has been in the crosshairs for this sort of radical socialist Marxist left for 200 years. At this point, so to really take down, to really fundamentally transform the human order, which they're seeking to do, they have to go after property, tradition, they have to go after religion, and they have to go after the Catholic Church.
You know, we've painted a pretty bleak picture here.
Yeah,
when you take a look at what we've discussed so far on the show,
I don't sleep well at night. I must tell you.
So the question is, what do we do? How do we change this? How do we change American culture in such a way that we can turn this around? I mean, the thought that's run through my mind a few times is maybe we need a third party that's kind of right down the middle, a moderate party, although moderate has become a dirty word these days. So
yeah.
What do we do? How do we fix this?
Well, I'm not very optimistic, I got to tell you that. But as a Catholic, I'm supposed to have faith, hope, and charity, right? But like Chesterton said, that hope is about having hope when things seem hopeless. That's why it's a virtue. You have to really strive for it. But it's hard to be hopeful. But I would say that you have to do things like we're doing here right now, and you guys with this show. This is part of the new evangelization. You need to educate, and educate. You do it by platforms like radio, podcasts, through writing articles, writing books, getting on YouTube, on the web, with as much bad stuff that's out there. Try to counter the bad stuff with good stuff. And for the kind of radical, secular, atheistic left, this has been a long march. What Antonio Gramsci called a long march through the institutions, through the cultural institutions, through education, Hollywood, media, and all you can do is sort of fight back. And I'd say one advantage is this: we really do have the truth and the Church on our side, but it's a matter of trying to get that truth out there. And when I speak to audiences all around the country. Spoke out there in your neighborhood, right? I guess it was 2017, and at the church in Carmel.
Mm-hmm. But Our Lady of Mount Carmel, right?
That's right. So you have to you have to try to, and that church, I think there were about 1,000 people there when I spoke, and a lot of them were young people. A lot of them were young people. And you see that when you present this point of view to young people who haven't heard it before, a lot of times we think, wow, they're going to be yelling at me from their seats, right? No, a lot of times they get a sort of literal eye-open look where you could tell, you could see the bulb go off, and they're thinking to themselves, wow, I haven't heard this before, but this makes sense, right? This makes sense. If you can get them to go and investigate a little bit more, listen a little bit more, in a way you can only change the culture by changing the hearts and minds of people one at a time. And if every single one of us just changed the minds of one person, you know, you'd have a whole lot better country and culture and church, hopefully, in 10 or 20 or 50 years.
Do you see a movement by Catholics away from the Democrat Party if it continues to become more and more socialist? Because it would seem that the socialist elements and ideology and platform are antithetical to Catholic teaching.
Well, it certainly is, and definitely the cultural left with, like you're going to see now in the House of Representatives, the first thing they're going to do is try to completely restore all funding for Planned Parenthood, which had been completely
horrible.
Cut.
That's a horrible idea.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Paul Ryan, the Catholic Speaker of the House, he and Republican leaders worked with a decent degree of success to get the federal government out of the abortion business. They didn't completely eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood, but they really cut it back.
Right.
And now that's going to be completely restored. In fact, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she's likely going to become Speaker again. She's a lifelong Catholic, and she calls abortion, quote, sacred ground to me.
Ugh, that's blasphemy.
Yeah, legalized abortion.
That's blasphemy.
Quote, sacred ground to me. Right.
Ugh, it's horrible.
And so that, now, in the most recent election, and these numbers were posted at National Catholic Register last week, the majority of Catholics voted Democrat.
It just surprises me because the, and maybe sometimes it's a vote for one party is because it's a shot at the other one, I suppose. But it surprises me with abortion being the centerpiece issue. And arguably, I think, and tell me if you agree with this, Dr. Kangor, I think Kavanaugh's nomination was all about abortion. And with that being a complete no-fly zone for faithful Catholics, it seems hard to vote for a Democrat that's pro-choice.
Right. And really, Catholics voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. I mean, they really gave – usually Catholics mirror the overall vote almost perfectly.
Right.
So, which would have meant in the last election, they would have gone 48% for Hillary and 46% for Trump. But instead, they gave Trump, I think, about a 10-point advantage and really won the Electoral College for Trump. But in this most recent election, I think they voted Democrat like 50-48. But really, guys, in that case, a part of being Catholic is it really is universal, right? Catholic means universal. And so a lot of people, when pollsters ask them, what religion are you? What denomination are you? Well, they're Catholic. But that's not necessarily a breakdown of the level of devoutness or faithfulness.
Yeah, mass attendance, for example.
Right, and that's the key question. When you ask them, okay, you're Catholic, how often do you attend Mass? And when they say once or twice a year, okay, this is true. Some people listening might get angry at me when I say this, but it's true. We have data on this. The Catholics who attend Mass just once or twice a year, they tend to vote more liberal. The ones who attend weekly usually vote more conservative. The ones who attend Mass more than once a week usually vote for the conservative pro-life candidate more closer to like two-thirds of the time. And you see this as well with Protestants. And so a lot of times evangelicals vote for conservative pro-life candidates, you know, three quarters, because most evangelicals, those tend to be the more devout Protestants, whereas the people in the mainline denominations, Episcopal Church, Methodist Church, they tend to vote more Democrat. But so if you break down religion according to mass attendance, faithfulness, church attendance, those folks tend to vote Republican and conservative more frequently.
We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on six continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
This station has been an inspiration.
Those moments of the Lord, it always makes my day better.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back. Within the Catholic community, do we have a confusion now between socialism and social justice?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, no question, Mark. I mean, it is, and you, there's a conflating of the terms where, and it's a shame. I remember Glenn Beck a few years ago when he was on Fox, and he got in a lot of trouble among a lot of Christian and Christian scholars, and including some of our guys at Grove City College who wrote some articles and went after him because he was saying, when you hear social justice, think of socialism, and you had different Christian scholars saying, well, that's not what social justice means. Beth, it doesn't mean socialism. Well, no, it doesn't, and it shouldn't. But unfortunately, the way that a lot of social justice warriors use it, it does mean socialism.
So, right.
Yeah, that's part of the problem, right? So when you run into Sister Social Justice out there, who, you know, talking social justice, social justice, social justice, she's not talking about, you know, as a lady from my church has a great shirt that says social justice begins in the womb, right?
Oh, I need one of those.
right. Isn't that a great shirt?
Yeah, put that on my Christmas list.
right. But a lot of the people who talk social justice aren't applying it to the unborn. They're not using that to rally people to go for the March for Life. They're using it to call for universal health care.
So they tend,
yeah. So they tend to use it for socialistic purposes, which is a misuse of how social justice was originally intended. But when a guy like Glenn Beck says, if you're in a church and someone's going on and on about social justice, construe that as meaning socialism. Well, unfortunately, in practice, that's turned out to be largely true.
Well, I think part of it, too, is this confusion around sort of the means to the end that, you know, as Catholics, I think we generally recognize that we ought to be engaged in social justice. In other words, being just to our brothers and sisters, and that's an important.
Yes.
In fact, justice is probably the single greatest virtue that society's trying to bring about. But it's the means by which we're doing it, which is, it seems that where the conflation maybe comes in is we think of government program as the means by which we bring about social justice instead of, well, no, actually, what brings about what should be bringing the means ought to be myself. I'm the one individually and personally for the purpose of salvation of my own soul and saving the souls of others. I'm the one that's called to corporal and spiritual works of mercy, not a large government bureaucracy.
That's right. And that's not how a lot of social justice people who frequently use that language, that's not how they're using it.
Correct.
I mean, really, my belief on this stuff is I very much follow the Catholic Church principle of subsidiarity. John Paul II favored that as well.
Tell us what that means when you say subsidiarity. Break that down for our audience a little bit.
Yeah, and so that means that the best way to approach a problem is by going to the means that's closest to the problem. So, for example, it's kind of a form of localism. So if you have homeless people in your community, the best way to deal with the homeless people is first you on a one-to-one level, you at your church, your local soup kitchen, maybe the local Rotary Club, the local Salvation Army group. And then if all of those different private things don't work in the local level, then maybe try the borough and then try the county. And if the county or the township doesn't work, then maybe go to the state level, meaning the state of Indiana, the state of Pennsylvania. And then only as a last resort would you go to Washington, which is farthest removed from the problem.
Right.
And you know, maybe the bureaucrat dealing with it in Washington has never been to Indianapolis or never been to Grove City. And in order to take it to that level, you lose about half of the money, actually half, probably literally 75% of the money gets swallowed up in the bureaucracy that has to deal with the problem and doesn't actually get to the person. But you should only go to the federal, to the Washington, to the national level as a last resort. Unfortunately, what happens with a lot of the social justice people is that they want to start with Washington, right?
Right.
They want to start there. They're doing that with health care now.
Right.
Right? They want to have it all in a single national, single-payer national bureaucracy. I mentioned Britain earlier, the National Health Service. They want to run it all out of one center in Washington. And you know, I myself, as a believer in subsidiarity, as a small C conservative, I believe in a local approach. And here again, if you disagree with them on that, they start calling you names and,
right.
and accusing you of nasty motives. We say, no, I want to help the poor too, I really do. But I'd rather do it at the local level, which I think is more effective than doing it at the level of Washington. Say, well, you're just a fascist, right?
Yeah.
No, I think local works better at this. Well, that's not social justice. Well, it is social justice, actually. I mean, you look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. Jesus calls on the Good Samaritan to help the guy up, pick him up, put him on his horse or donkey, take him to the inn, go to the innkeeper and say, here's money for this, I'll come back and I'll check on the guy. I mean, he's not yelling, hey, everybody, is there a Jerusalem bureaucrat here who can take care of this? Everybody, hey, come here. I want $5 from everybody's pocket to take care of this guy. See y'all later. I'm taking off. No, I mean, he takes care of the wounded traveler on the road to Jericho, right? He takes care of the guy himself. I mean, that's
right.
True social justice.
Right. Well, you know what? We're out of time with this particular segment, or just about. Give us, if you could, Dr. Paul Kangor, give us an idea of what some of your current projects are and how folks can keep in touch with you.
Oh, well, thanks. Yes, so my most recent book, I did A Pope and a President on
Love
John
that.
Paul II. Yeah,
Love
and Ronald
that.
Reagan, and that's what I spoke about out in your neck of the woods, and The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. And I'm right now working on a major documentary film on Ronald Reagan and John Paul II. It's called The Divine Plan. And if you go to the website for The Divine Plan, you'll see the trailer there. It's wait till you guys see it. It's fantastic. It's done by Rob Orlando. Yeah. He's interviewed Cardinal Dolan, Bishop Barron, George Weigel, all the Reagan biographers, Doug Brinkley, the editor of the Reagan Diaries, H.W. Brands, really, really good stuff. So we're working on that right now. I have a regular column for American Spectator. I work at Grove City College. You can find some of my writings at our website for the Center for Vision and Values.
You got a ton of books on Amazon to pick up. I love Takedown. I love Dupes. Those are, along with Pope and a President, those are some of my favorites that you've written. But, boy, anything you've put a pen to, I've truly enjoyed and would highly recommend to our audience. And, Kent Mark and I would love to have free front row passes to the premiere of the movie, should that become available. But we do want to help promote it. So we're going to have
come
back
to Indianapolis and screen it. I'd love to do that.
We'll work with you on that.
I would.
I think that'd be something certainly doable. We'd love to do that. Thank you for your time today. It's really been it was a fascinating show. We're going to have you back really soon.
Oh, anytime, guys. You know how to reach me.
Okay, and that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave today. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, and for our guest, Dr. Paul Kengor, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.